From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan's GOP leaders prepare to push a right-to-life ballot initiative into law to ban a common abortion procedure. And then?
Michigan law would likely be challenged. Eventually, the Supreme Court could consider bans like this as they wrestle with abortion rights issues.
The push to close Detroit's digital divide.
One of the things Amazon had said was, we want to find a place that has a strong tech workforce, a strong tech ecosystem. That was what they looked for. And if we're talking about, you know, this huge population of households that aren't connected to the internet, can you really justify saying that you have a strong one? And that's just not really likely.
And some of our favorite Michigan history moments, including World War I's Hello Girls.
I just found it fascinating that they wanted to use women because they could pay them less. However, men couldn't have done that job.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, nearly half of Detroit households cannot afford to pay for pricey internet access, but the city's new director of digital inclusion plans to change that. We'll find out how when we hear from him later in the program. But first, Michigan's Republicans appear poised to take a right-to-life ballot proposal and pass it into law, completely bypassing Governor Gretchen Whitmer and her promised veto. Jonathan Osting of Bridge Magazine is here with us. Jonathan, what does the right-to-life ballot proposal say? What would it do?
Yeah, so what this proposal would do is effectively ban what is the most common form of second trimester abortion. It's called a dilation and evacuation method. And it would do so by criminalizing physicians or other medical providers who actually perform the abortions. They could face prison time or fines if they actually use this procedure for an abortion. They could also be subject to new lawsuits from spouses or parents of women, even who have abortions if they're under the age of 18. So it wouldn't criminalize women themselves, but it would certainly make it very, very difficult for them to find this sort of procedure. There would, however, be an exception for physicians. They wouldn't face criminal penalties if they were performing this in a circumstance that it was deemed appropriate given the health or risks of death to the mother.
Okay. And so bring us up to date. What's the latest with Right to Life's effort to get petition signatures?
Yeah, so they've reached their self-imposed cutoff date for collecting signatures. They've asked volunteers from all over the state, and they do have many of them, about 8,000, they said, to send in all their petitions. They've got most of those now, if not all of them. They're sorting through them. They're checking and double-checking their lists because they want to make sure when they turn in these signatures that they've basically already, you know, removed duplicates or flagged any problem signatures to ensure that when the Bureau of Elections here in Michigan actually reviews them, they're going to find that they have enough signatures to proceed. So they need about 340,000 valid signatures to advance this initiated legislation to the Michigan legislature. And they're projecting right now they're going to end up with 374,000, which would give them about a 10% buffer.
And then what do legislative leaders intend on doing with the measure?
Yeah, so the legislature would have 40 days to take it up. If they did nothing, it would go to the ballot, but they intend to take up the legislation and approve it, and that would actually enact it. It would turn it into law without the signature of Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who is very opposed to the measure. We know this for a couple reasons. A, both of them told me this
okay.
week.
There you go.
Speaker Lee Chatfield and Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, although Shirkey said it was likely. He did raise the possibility that it could be other strategy considerations in play. But Chatfield said, you know, if this reaches them, he fully anticipates the legislature will pass them. The second reason we know that the legislature is likely to do this is actually approve this is that they already have once before. Both the House and Senate voted on very, very similar legislation earlier this year. They did so separately, and they didn't send the bill to the governor's desk. Governor Whitmer was very clear she would veto it. So for whatever reason, Republicans decided not to, force the issue. Instead, Right to Life was talking to them very early on about this other strategy of going around the governor via a petition drive, and they're awaiting that legislation to come to them now so they can vote on it again.
Spell out what the likely legal battle is that could be fought.
Yeah, so the likely legal battle is simply that this goes too far and places an undue burden on a legal right to abortion. Of course, under Roe v. Wade, it is an established constitutional right, abortion. And these laws like this, banning this specific procedure, have been challenged in other states. Mm-hmm. I think it was not challenged in two states that passed it, so there are two states that actually have this law on the books and in force, but in about 10 others, the law was actually suspended or is otherwise still wrapped up in court and hasn't yet taken effect. In fact, one case in Alabama, actually, the law was suspended, and they appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court this summer declined to hear it. In other words, they let the lower court ruling stand that suspended the law, but conservative Justice Clarence Thomas was clear that he thinks there could be a case eventually down the line that will give the Supreme Court the opportunity to reassess its own standard for what constitutes an undue burden for abortion rights. So, in other words, he was, sort of pushing the court to say, let's take something up like this at some point. So the Michigan law would likely be challenged. Eventually, the Supreme Court could consider bans like this as they wrestle with abortion rights issues.
Jonathan Osteng, Bridge Magazine. Thank you, Jonathan.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Michigan's governor, tribal nations, and environmental groups are all calling for a shutdown of Line 5, the pipeline carrying oil underneath the Straits of Mackinac. They say this pipeline, over 60 years old, poses too great a risk of leaking. But the pipeline doesn't just carry oil. The liquid mix includes propane that's delivered to Michigan's Upper Peninsula. So what would happen to UP households using propane if Line 5 is shut down? Interlochen Public Radio's Kayla Fahn traveled across the Mackinac Bridge to try to get to the bottom of this.
James Ball makes his way through multiple feet of snow in his backyard. He's headed to check the gauge on his propane tank.
I'm at 50%, so I'll maybe call next week or in 2 weeks and set up a time for have him come out and fill it up.
Ball's home in Rapid River, Michigan has had propane heat for as long as he's lived there. The majority of the UP heats with natural gas, but it's often not available in rural areas like the one where Ball lives. So 18% of Upper Peninsula households heat primarily with propane. It's not unheard of for a family to spend $2,000 filling their tank over a winter. And Ball says one winter a few years ago, there was a propane shortage. Many states in the Midwest declared propane emergencies in the winter of 2013 and 2014.
When I called to order propane, they said that there was a possibility that it would not be available by the time that my tank ran out.
It concerned him so much that now he only uses propane as a last resort. He put a wood pellet stove in his basement, and he also has a standard wood stove in his living room. But he's getting older.
There'll come a time when I will no longer be able to cut wood. There's costs. Pellets are fairly expensive. You got to transport those and haul them in, so.
He might have to rely on propane again, and he's concerned about anything that might change its price. That includes a possible shutdown of Enbridge's Line 5, which delivers propane to a facility just a few miles from his house. Most of what's in the pipeline flows right through the Upper Peninsula, then under the Straits of Mackinac, through the Lower Peninsula, and ultimately to Canada. But in Rapid River, a relatively small amount of propane is extracted from Line 5 and sold to retailers. Enbridge claims that small amount meets 65% of the Upper Peninsula's propane demands. A prominent environmental nonprofit has said it's more like 35 to 50%. But propane is an unregulated fuel, so there's a lack of publicly available information. Either way, propane that doesn't come to the UP by pipeline comes by rail and truck. Warren Vilcheski with the U.S. Energy Information Administration says there's a hard and fast rule for transporting propane.
Rail and truck are significantly more expensive than pipe.
Analyses conducted on behalf of the state and the National Wildlife Federation estimate that propane prices could go up anywhere from 5 to 38 cents a gallon without Line 5. But propane markets are complicated, and without concrete data, it's hard to predict what will happen. Guy Bowman is the former owner of Bowman Gas, a propane retailer serving the Upper Peninsula. He says before 1996, when Line 5 began delivering propane to Rapid River, the UP did just fine. But Rapid River made things more convenient.
It's basically like the new grocery store coming to town. Everybody goes to the new grocery store because it's handy, and you forget about the little places you used to go, and they close up because you're going to the big store. Well, that's what happened here.
Bowman Gas gets about half of their propane from Line 5, and the other half from rail. But Bowman says some propane retailers have come to rely on Line 5 completely. He says infrastructure for rail and trucking has deteriorated as a result. He doesn't want to lose Line 5, but he thinks the Upper Peninsula could manage as long as there was time to plan.
The infrastructure's got to be built back up again to do without it. And with the way trucking is nowadays and as reliable as rail is nowadays, I mean, we could get by. It wouldn't be, I guess I would say, fun.
If Line 5 had to be shut down quickly, like in the case of an oil spill, the impacts could be more serious. To help mitigate this risk, Governor Gretchen Whitmer created the UP Energy Task Force. One of their tasks is to come up with a propane plan for the UP in the case of a Line 5 shutdown. They're supposed to produce a report by March of 2020. Task Force member Tanya Sweenor says they're currently trying to get to the bottom of a lot of conflicting information. Sweenor works with the Superior Watershed Partnership in Marquette, which has programs that help people use less propane. Personally, she thinks that's the best option to help offset any costs from a Line 5 closure.
When people learn how to conserve energy, they're going to be saving money and they're going to consume less. So that's going to bring their bill costs down.
But no matter what, Sweenor says she thinks the UP will find a way to make things work.
That was reporter Kayla Fahn for Points North, a weekly show and podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. You can find more episodes at pointsnorthradio.org. Coming up, with the advent of services like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, tracing your family roots is easier than ever. But the legacy of slavery and discrimination can mean it's harder for African Americans to build a family tree. We talk with two women helping them overcome those barriers. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you decide to dig into your family's roots, a typical approach is tracking down your ancestors' birth and death certificates, perhaps marriage records at a county office or a church. But that is not always an option for African Americans, whose roots go back to American slavery, where family ties meant absolutely nothing to slave owners, and buying and selling human beings meant families could be torn apart in an instant. My next guests are focused on helping other African Americans trace their family roots. Here now are the co-founders of the Washtenaw County African American Genealogy Society. We have Cheryl Garnett and Omer Jean Winborn. It's so good to have you here at Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you. So you've both been doing genealogical research on your own families for years, and I'm interested how you each became interested in doing this kind of research. Omer Jean, tell us how that began for you.
My father migrated here from the South in the 40s. He raised six children, and so one day, and I was working on my third degree, and my dad looked at me and said, "I wonder if they could teach an old man like me how to read." My father couldn't read. I was shocked. Who is this man? Where did I come from? How did I get here? He could not read.
And you're on your third degree.
Yes, I could not believe it. So then I started looking into my history. I joined Fred Hart Williams because I wanted some help. Fred Hart Williams is a genealogical society in Detroit. This is our 40th anniversary, and so I'm vice president of that organization, okay. And Cheryl is on the board with me. So I drug her, being my good friend, because she has such wonderful Canadian history.
So what about you, Cheryl? Was it because of Omar Jean that you started thinking of genealogy research?
No. When I was 16, my grandmother gave me our family tree. She wanted me to finish our family tree. Our family tree ended with her and her siblings. My grandmother died in 1997, and that's when I picked up the tree and said, I need to finish this for my grandmother. When I was 16, I folded it up and put it away because I wasn't interested and didn't know how to do it or what to do with it. But 1997, I said, I need to finish this for my grandmother, and started doing the research.
And then what motivated you to begin helping other African Americans do the kind of research you're doing?
I went with Cheryl for 20 years to her family's house. And I remember the first time I walked around the house and she said, this is where my grandmother used to collect rainwater to wash my hair. And I said, oh, you actually came to this cabin? She said, yes. And she said, this is where some of the people that were enslaved, this is the graveyard where they died. There's the wagon where they lived. And so for 20 years, we were going up to Canada. And then we found out, after doing DNA and after doing history and stuff, that we're related. We're cousins.
Mm-hmm. And you were friends before. Mm-hmm. And
40 years friendship.
Isn't that?
And it was so phenomenal that we had to share what we learned with other African-American people. And that's our life's work right now, mm-hmm. is to go around and show people how to do this.
You're part of this activity in Detroit, but there was nothing like this in Washtenaw County. So the both of you said, well, guess what? We're founding the Washtenaw County African-American Genealogy Society. Tell us more about the challenges that African-Americans face in tracking down their family histories. What kind of challenges, Omar Jean, do they face?
Because the people that were enslaved were sold, hired out so many times and so different, our ancestors are smiling because we're getting back together. We're finding everybody. We're finding our connections. And it's challenging. For the first, from 1940, when the first census came out, until 1870, that's when you need to trace your history. Then at 1870, things begin to change because that's the first census where African American are listed by name. But prior to that, you've got to do some research and then some puzzles. And everybody's stories are not the same. So you have to think about what was going on in 1870. That was 5 years after the Civil War. Was your ancestor part of the Civil War? What part did they play? What state were they in? What was the battle? Were they in Michigan or were they in the South? Where were they? And so it becomes a puzzle, and you have to take it apart, and you have to look at everybody individually. You can't just blanket say that everybody were enslaved. Not all people were enslaved. Both of our people were free. Cheryl is really the genealogist. I'm not. So Cheryl has discovered that our ancestors were also Black loyalists. And so we're studying that. And that's there's a tremendous opening for that in a history that's not known. And that is, if you don't understand what Black loyalists is, Cheryl explained it to me, is that they fought with the British against the United States for land and their freedom in Nova Scotia.
What is that like for people when they start to get a sense of their family history?
We're doing a case study, and I was working with someone, and we found out that his ancestor in the 1853, I believe it was worth $14,000. You have to share that with everybody who's African American. And I share a lot of stuff with Cheryl. And I said, Cheryl, you know what? I wonder, $14,000 in 1850? What did he do? And Cheryl says, well, he probably was a blacksmith because this person was treating him for burns. It's still a mystery. We're still working and we're still trying to find out what's happening. But when we saw that on the paper, he started crying and I started crying. And we just sat there for about 5 minutes and absorbed that, to take that in, to actually see that your ancestor was enslaved and the power that it brought to us and knowing who he was and how he got there.
What are ways, when you don't have the marriage certificates and the death certificates that people take for granted, what are some tools?
Like Jean said, it's like putting together pieces of a puzzle. So it's figuring out where your family was, who did they live near, what area, what was going on in that area, who were their neighbors, who were they connected to. I mean, it becomes a challenge, but it's not an impossible challenge. It becomes a life's work, and you become obsessed with it. DNA has helped because with the DNA, people are making connections. I got a message from someone who lives in Colorado, and it's like, Colorado? How do I get a cousin in Colorado? She was related to my great-great-grandmother's sister, you know, and it's like putting together these connections that I would have never known.
So these mail-order DNA test kits that are being heavily advertised, and they're very present now, that must have really been a game changer.
That's how we found out that we were connected. And it was like a roundabout way, but we found out, and then the connection was to the Canadian ancestors and to find out that they were on the same settlement just through the DNA. That has meant so much to African Americans, because even though I know some people will disagree with it, that has helped us with our connections and putting our family back together.
Right. And that's one of the main things is the DNA gives you the hint, but once you can find the papers, the documentation, and that's what we say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're mixing this modern technology of the DNA kits with that good old fashioned, you know, boots on the ground, combing through archives
and
being a detective.
Being a detective.
Yes.
And then you can put those pieces together and confirm that, yes, indeed, this is a relative. I have the paperwork that confirms it. I have the marriage license. I have the death certificates. And that's another thing, finding the death certificates that have the names of the parents, you know, that have the names of the people who identified the person.
Have you been able to help any people trace as far back as their African roots?
We're at that place now. We're trying to get our, Cheryl and I, before we can show anybody else how to do that, Cheryl is guiding me. She's a really researcher, but she's guiding me back to Africa, almost to the slave ship. With the discovery of the Black Loyalists, we'll be able to tell. Because we're researching now. She's doing most of the research.
That's my new research project. Mm-hmm.
How do you see people's lives change, your lives change, because there's not a cloud anymore when you look to the past, when you can feel these connections with people who precede you and you feel knit together? How does that change your life?
It just makes me complete. Now I know who I am. It's no longer just my father. I didn't know my grandmother because my grandmother was deceased, both grandparents on both sides. I didn't know them, but it makes my story whole and complete, and it makes me so very proud.
And Cheryl?
The same for me. I have such a love of my ancestors. I am so grateful for who they were and what they did and what they accomplished. I have a third great grandmother, Jane King, who was a white woman, who fell in love with one of the men who was a slave of her husband. Her husband and the gentleman that was enslaved, John Walls. John and Daniel were friends. They grew up together. In fact, they were born on the same day. John's mother nursed the two of them together. They grew up as babies and toddlers, as friends. The story is that one day they changed roles. And John's pretended to be the slave owner, and Daniel pretended to be the slave. Well, Daniel's father saw that, became furious, beat John, forbid them to play together ever again. And John's father, in seeing that, ran away, was captured, and was killed in front of John. John's mother was sold away. That so affected Daniel that he promised John his freedom. And before he died, he gave John his freedom. On his deathbed, asked John to take care of Jane. Well, they fell in love. He and Jane fell in love. And they knew they couldn't stay there. So they took off for Indiana with Jane's four children. And they were married by Quakers in Indiana. And then during the 1850s, when the word was out that there was going to be the Fugitive Slave Act, that they took off for Canada. So Jane and her life has had a great meaning for me because her courage and her strength, and I never knew where I had this attitude. I have an attitude, you know, just kind of quiet, but this nobody can tell me what to do attitude, this temper that I sometimes have. I used to say this eye rolling, head rolling isn't African American. It's my Irish, Scottish temper. You know, it comes from Jane King. You know, this don't take no stuff. you know, because she picked up and left. She put her life
she's
and
a
her
tough
children.
Lady.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
her children and herself. She gave up all of her privilege. She gave up all of her land. She left her family and everything for what she believed in. And she actually became an abolitionist. She came back to the U.S. twice to free other people. Her life and her life story is a part of who I am and why I'm the kind of person that I am.
It was so great to hear your stories, Cheryl Garnett and Omer Jean Winborn, who are co-founders of the Washtenaw County African American Genealogy Society. It's clear it's such a passion for both of you. Thank you for sharing it with us.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. To mark my final history conversation, Rachel Clark and Mark Harvey of the Michigan History Center are here with us, and we're going to go around the table and share some of the favorite stories that we have talked about. We've covered so much, and welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Rachel, you go first. What is your favorite story?
I think my first favorite was the Hello Girls story that we did quite a while ago.
All right, remind us of that.
So, the Hello Girls were World War I operators on the front lines, and there were a few of them that were from Michigan, and they were an integral part of communicating orders throughout the trenches. And I just found that so fascinating.
It is, because we've heard about the ambulance drivers, mm-hmm. we've heard about the medics, certainly the soldiers and nurses.
Yes.
But the Hello Girls have been forgotten.
They were. And they were used because they could be paid less. However, they had a job that men could not do. Men could not run that switchboard. It was just too complicated and too integral. And women had training in being operators. And so I just found it fascinating that they wanted to use women because they could pay them less. However, men couldn't have done that job. So
interesting.
I just really enjoyed that story.
That was a great story. Mark, what's your first fave?
It was an early one again. The invention of Muzak from the gentleman in Lapeer, Michigan, George Owen Squire.
Oh, my word. You know, baby boomers for sure grew up with this everywhere. Remind us again how this came to be. Muzak was so omnipresent in American life. Not so much now.
I'm still recovering from my days as a grocery store worker and having to stock the shelves to some of the worst Muzak in the history of music.
But so who do we have to thank for Muzak?
He was in the military, George Owen Squire, and he was from Lapeer, Michigan, and he went to West Point and was in the Signal Corps and came up with this technology of sending audio communication over wired instances, and came back out of the Army and decided to make a business of this. Radio was new.
Yes.
And that was the hot thing in the 20s after World War I. And this seemed much more prudent and sure, because you wouldn't lose signal if it was over the wire. It snowballed into being piped into factories to increase production. I think this one this song might decrease production.
as people kind of nod off.
Yeah.
No, they'd be in doctor's offices and that. And you didn't have copyright issues to deal with, I think, if you had your Muzak subscription.
Exactly. That was all taken care of for you. And it was a big industry. They would hire, Count Basie and these other artists did Muzak. They would get the best musicians to do it.
But it had to be innocuous. It had to not impinge on whatever was going on. It was like background painting.
Elevator music.
Elevator music, Muzak, and it was all because of Michigan. That's a great one. Well, my first favorite story was the moment, Rachel, when you told us something about one of the most famous photos of World War II. It was taken on the eve of D-Day at an airfield in England, and everyone who knows me knows that I cannot get enough of World War II history. And remind us again about that photo. It was General Eisenhower talking to some of the Screaming Eagles, the paratroopers of the 101st Airborne, and there was a big Michigan connection in this mm-hmm. famous photo.
Yes, this was Wallace Strobel from Saginaw, Michigan, and that is an iconic photo, and it's a photo that I've seen my whole life and never realized that that was a Michigan soldier.
Yeah.
And they're about to leave on D-Day, and Eisenhower came in and was speaking with them, and That was a fun story to research.
And when you think of this picture, and you can find it anywhere, folks, and it's they're all, they've got their paint on, they're all geared up and ready to climb aboard and cross the channel. And he's the tall beanpole. He's a tall string bean right in the middle. And I have to say, when I was with our Michigan radio listeners on our tour of France this past summer, and we went to Normandy, and of course you see that picture, and I went, he's from Michigan. Rachel told us we did that. And there was also another Michigan connection in all of that, Staff Sergeant Charles Staub of Birmingham, mm-hmm. and he was in the Weather Service.
He was in the Weather Service. So the Weather Service was an integral part of D-Day because without decent weather, the paratroopers couldn't go in. None of it could happen, really. D-Day had been delayed, and there were a lot of conversations about whether they go in the current weather conditions at that time. And he was part of that crew that finally gave the, yes, now's the time. Mm. Yeah, the weather is fine.
As I remember then, Staff Sergeant Staub was injured. Mm-hmm. He was wounded during the war, but he made it home.
Yep.
And Lieutenant Wallace Strobel of Saginaw?
He also made it home. So both of them were lucky and were able to return.
Well, as I've often said, as a history major, there's nothing that would make me happier than the producer team saying, so we got a history topic for you. Or when we launched this weekly series, the Michigan History Center, looking at State of Michigan stories. Oh, my goodness. It was just wonderful. So thank you for all that you've brought, your historian skills, but your personalities and finding cool stories for all of us to dig our teeth into. It has been really fun. Mark Harvey and Rachel Clark, Michigan History Center, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Much more ahead after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Think of the countless reasons we go online to communicate with friends, get informed, take classes, find and apply for a job, apply for unemployment or food assistance, college financial aid, and so much more. As more organizations and government offices shift from in-person to online access, people who do not have access to the internet are really left behind, and that would be 40% of Detroit's households. Earlier this year, I talked with Detroit's Director of Digital Inclusion, Joshua Edmonds, and we talked about how the city is trying to bridge that digital divide. Here's our conversation. Joshua, the FCC has defined high-speed internet as a public utility and made connecting American homes to the web a top priority. Why is it so many people in the city don't have a good way to get online?
Well, at the onset, and I, you know, when you were doing your introductory piece, you really hit on many of the nuances that I think a lot of people take for granted. Now, in terms of why people are struggling to get online, I think that we had to look at that and unpack that a little bit. It is looking at perpetual access. You have some people where maybe during tax refund season, they're able to essentially, you know, get online for a little bit. They have a little windstream of cash to be able to pay for an internet bill. However, when months get tough, the first bill that goes is the internet. And so what we're looking at and the measurement that you had touched on with the households, that is, you know, people who essentially are already struggling with, you know, keeping the lights on, getting water in the home. And if you had to choose between internet or water, I mean, 11 times out of 10, you're going to choose, you know, water. So I think that, you know, we have to look at the cost as a huge barrier. And this is, I don't blame my telecommunication companies. Some people in this role, in similar roles, will always, you know, go after the telecoms. And I think that it's, you know, up to us as a community to begin looking at a lot of the low-cost offerings and really make a communal push to educate residents and the stakeholders in the community on a lot of these low-cost options, because cost is such a barrier for the internet in today.
Yeah, cost is a barrier. And, you know, I know one option in some communities would be the public library, but because of financial troubles, the public libraries in Detroit, many of them have closed those branch libraries where you could maybe walk in and hop online.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess when you think about cost, what else? What else is that the main reason, or what are some of the other barricades?
Sure. So cost, yes, that is like the big one universally. However, there's three. So it always comes down to cost, relevance, and skill. Relevance is a huge barrier you're going to find, especially amongst your senior population, where they'll say, hey, look, I made it this far in life. I didn't need the internet then. I don't need it now. And I would say, you know, the internet's not a panacea. I don't want to force it or inundate anyone, you know, with it. But at the same time, you know, you have to educate them again to what you said in the beginning, all of those different services that are going online. If you are using any type of social service, the internet is relevant to you. And so making that case and showing the ways that it's relevant to you, that's been something that I've been very interested in doing, particularly with my seniors. And then again, that skill piece, I think that affects that's a whole spectrum-based approach where just a lot of people are saying, you know what, you guys are talking about this internet. Now I hear 5G and I don't even have, you know, internet in my home. What in the world? You know, forget it. I just don't know what people are doing. I'm just going to opt out.
Throw up your hands.
Absolutely. And so we're seeing a lot of that bundled together. And I would like to boil it down to just saying that people are digitally disenfranchised.
And here we're talking about seniors, but it's worth noting 70% of Detroit school children have no internet access at home. And boy, that sure can help school performance.
Yes, absolutely. So we always talk about the homework gap. And you know, it's real. A lot of times people don't really understand some of the nuances associated with the homework gap. But when you take something, for example, like a research paper, it could be a 1 or 2 page paper on any topic, really. That paper might not necessarily have to be completed online. However, there's online components needed to actually do the research. And, you know, you brought up a great example with the libraries because the counterpoint, someone would say, well, you can do the research at a library. Just go to a library. Well, yeah, if you live close, but mobility is a huge issue for many Detroiters. And so the library, I love them as an institution. I was raised on public libraries. I think that they are great. And thus far in my time in Detroit, they've been a great partner for me. But what I've been stressing to people is we need more players in this space. It can't just be a few institutions. This has to be a community thing. If you are a church and you're already doing this work, open up the doors and let people kind of come in and, you know, do their homework there. I mean, there's so many different ways that we can do this at a communal level.
And I think it's worth just taking a moment to do a great big shout out to the wonderful main branch of the Detroit Library right there in the Cultural Center on Woodward. It's fabulous, but it doesn't help you if you're living on the far east side of the city and transportation's an issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I guess when you think about unpacking things, talk a little more about how this is holding people back.
So I would say it's a number of ways. So, I mean, let's say, for example, let's look at a regular family. Regular family you can think of, you know, mom, dad in the house and kids.
Yeah.
We've seen, and this is coming from Ohio, Ohio's finding at the Ohio State University, they looked at broadband and like the value that broadband actually brings from an economic perspective. And they're saying that households on average, there's an $1,800 swing per household that's connected to broadband. And that $1,800 is not just, you know, just a regular cost. I mean, that's more so like these houses with broadband tend to be able to access jobs faster. So if you're looking for a job, it's kind of a no-brainer that it's like, oh, well, you know, you got the internet. That's kind of where they're being advertised at this point. And even past that, there's a familiarity component with that too, where if I'm looking for jobs online, I must have some type of online familiarity or at least some type of technical familiarity or savviness. And so if people who are already struggling to use the computer to look for a job, then what actually happens when they actually get into the job? I mean, it could be, we're not even talking about coding at this point. We're talking about just really basic data processing that could be very intimidating for many people. So it's like, okay, from the workforce development standpoint, this is a critical need. When Amazon HQ2 was happening and it was the craze, oh, where are they going to relocate? One of the things Amazon had said was, we want to find a place that has a strong tech workforce, a strong tech ecosystem. That was what they looked for. And if we're talking about, you know, this huge population of households that aren't connected to the internet, can you really justify saying that you have a strong one? That's just not really likely. So, I mean, that's literally one angle. The other angle that, you know, I've been telling people, and this is a great way for banks to get involved, because we know there's a Community Reinvestment Act, and at least I haven't seen it here. Maybe some people have been able to do it, but you can leverage Community Reinvestment Act dollars for broadband investment. And the whole push on this one, where the banks kind of play a role, because if we have online banking being a thing, then in order for people to take advantage of that, you know, it all goes back to the internet. So it's like from one end, you know, I'm talking about workforce. Another end, you hear me talking about banking. We've already done the, you know, K-12 homework gap example. And that one you can honestly continuously unpack, because I have two incredible interns I was able to hire last week. One of them's at University of Michigan, the other one's at University of Chicago. And they're with me, well, they're not in the studio right now, but they're with me at the city. And both of them told me when they went in for their freshman year in college, both of them did not know how to type.
Wow.
And so it's like things like this. They are getting into incredible institutions, and they don't even know how to, you know, do a very, very basic thing like typing. And so it's like, what future are we sending our kids off into or to embark on? It's just one that's very, very uncertain, and I don't think it has to be. And so again, we can continuously unpack and go into so many different levels, but I mean, it's honestly endless. And for me, I have not ruled out a single person as a stakeholder in Detroit. I have said it. If you are a resident in Detroit, if you are a business in Detroit of any type, you are a stakeholder to me. Because I mean, it's as ubiquitous as the internet is, that's kind of how my effort I want it to be as well.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Joshua Edmonds, who's Detroit's Director of Digital Inclusion. You know, Joshua, here we're talking about lack of access to the internet in urban areas like Detroit, but we hear a lot about that also in many rural areas. I mean, what's going on here? Are there similarities?
Yes, yes. So there are clear similarities, and there are differences too. You know, the rural places, they might have one provider. In urban cities, we really don't have the same internet access issue, per se, as your rural places. We have a lot of broadband assets that are available. It's just that people can't afford to take advantage of those. So, I mean, the access, you'll see it. It's just people aren't really subscribing it to it based on those barriers to internet adoption we touched on earlier.
Right.
However, for the rural people, they're like, look, we legitimately don't have the infrastructure in place. And if we do, it's really, really spotty. And it's, you know, what you're paying for in some of these cases is not even, you're not even getting broadband at this point. You're getting, you know, just basic internet, but it's incredibly expensive. Those are two separate issues. But what I do believe there's a great opportunity to have a discussion between, you know, rural and urban is that for urban folks, it's, we already have the internet service providers here. We can't afford it. So for the rural people, it's like, okay, once we get them here, affordability will be a concern. How is urban taking care of that right now? So I think it's a really great opportunity to work together there. It just doesn't happen enough.
And the end result, the end impact on people's lives is the same, urban and rural.
Absolutely.
So as Director of Digital Inclusion, how are you going to be able to close this digital divide in Detroit? What are you doing to close the gap?
At the moment, I'm doing things like this.
mean, getting out there. I know you're newly appointed. You're getting into the ropes here.
Absolutely. You know, I have a strategy that I believe will definitely work. But, you know, and this is kind of just from years of studying in this field and implementing a few successful projects myself in when I was in Cleveland.
Yeah. In fact, we should mention to everybody, you were doing digital inclusion work in Cleveland. So,
yes.
Yeah, what lessons did you learn there that you're going to bring to Detroit?
Oh, man. I mean, where do I start? I would say at the very beginning, community equity matters. That has been a core belief of mine. It doesn't matter how great your strategy is. If you're not able to get the buy-in from the stakeholders you need and the user group you need, it's not really useful. And what I mean by that, the core stakeholders, at least I should say the residents, it's the residents 200% or below at the poverty level. These are people who are facing widespread housing insecurity, who will move, you know, 4 to 5 times a year, people who, you know, are very reliant on social services. I need to get those people, that pool of residents, because when we're looking at that huge percentage of people not adopting the internet, that's the population right there that I need. And so for me, it's like I could have a foolproof strategy, but if I'm not in the community building that equity, building relationships with community stakeholders who are already doing this work, then, you know, my strategy doesn't work. And so in Cleveland, you know, we were very fortunate when I was working at the Cleveland Foundation. Cleveland Foundation, you know, being one of the largest foundations in America, we were able to essentially capitalize on that community equity. And the investments we did were, you know, we did a few, but it was because we had that equity already built up. So right now I've just been on a listening tour, hearing out people's concerns. I don't want to be invasive with any of my technology, but rather be much more integrative in the way that we can use technology to integrate into existing social networks that people have been able to build with community-facing organizations.
But the big thing is cost, so you're going to need money. Who's going to give you money?
Absolutely, everybody.
Well, love your optimism.
Well, no, I mean, honestly, yes, while cost is definitely an issue, I'm not really looking to look at like public dollars, like how let's get a tax increase to do mm-hmm. this. I'm not looking to do that. I'm looking to be as lean and as effective as possible. You know, obviously everyone mentions the foundations here, but you know, there's certain elements of the strategy that I'm kind of pushing for. For example, I'll give away one of the things.
All right.
give it all, but one of them. You know, the other day I was meeting with a nonprofit in the community on the east side, and I was saying that, you know, one of the big things that people take advantage of at the libraries are the library's Wi-Fi. You know, people will literally just go into the parking lot, sit there, and connect to their Wi-Fi. It's already been programmed in many of the people's brains in the community collectively that libraries have Wi-Fi. And so I said, you know, libraries aren't the only entities that have Wi-Fi, but yet, you know, everyone's kind of going to them. So I said, what way can I, for example, talk to nonprofits and say, hey, do you guys have Wi-Fi on site? People are using it. Why can't we kind of publicize that? Why can't we let them know that there are free networks all around us? I mean, I think that everyone's really looking for the city of Detroit to come in and create a Detroit-wide Wi-Fi network. Sadly, I don't believe that we have the assets to do so. That's millions and millions and millions of dollars, especially for the city the size of Detroit. However, when we look at all these faith-based organizations, you look at all these nonprofits, you look at all these different entities that already have free Wi-Fi on the site. And so for me, we're like, this is a really easy lift. Can't we just find a way where we can empower residents with decision-making to say that if, you know, aside from you catching that bus to go 45 minutes to your nearest library, what about that church on the corner that has Wi-Fi? What about that, you know, nonprofit over here? I mean, it's thinking like that, and that's a community-driven way, and that's not a whole lot of money to do that, if any. That's just more so us just saying we have a service that we didn't know that we could publicize.
And there you go. You could create homework spaces and workspaces
Absolutely.
For people. What would success look like to you? What do you want Detroit's digital access picture to look like in 5 years?
Oh, yes. I love this. So 5 years from now, I no longer want us to be up. So let me backtrack. Of cities of 100,000 residents or more, Detroit is the least connected city in America. I don't even want to be in the bottom 10 of that anymore. And I honestly believe with the plan that, you know, we're putting in place and the equity that we're building up right now, realistically, we won't be in the bottom 10 anymore. I'm being bold in this one. I really am. But that's us being out of that bottom 10. And that is us illuminating pathways and providing residents the options to be able to choose to, if I want to be, for example, if I want to be a software developer, what is the exact residential pathway that I can take? Don't point me to, you know, some really, really expensive boot camp. Don't point me, what community assets can I take advantage of? And that's empowering people at so many different levels. That approach goes across the board. If I want to connect to this or that, you know, what does that look like? Can we get a connected Detroit where every single entity or organization recognizes there's a divide and they're doing things such as nominal as to what you pointed out. Hey, we have homework centers here. We have an extra room. We're going to be here from 5 to 7:30 already. You guys want to come in here to use our Wi-Fi, use our computer labs. I mean, it's literally, I think, to see an integrated Detroit where we are collectively working together and no one entity is owning this entire process.
And you're, I'm sure, going to be building models that other areas that are on the wrong side of the digital divide can learn from.
Absolutely. You know, it's really, really interesting because I've been looking for just the non-typical partners, people that are like, why would you want to, why are you partnering with them? And to give you an example, I spoke to recently Gleaners, the, you know, food distribution network. And I was talking to them. I'm like, wow, you guys might think that this is crazy. I'm reaching out to you, but just hear me out. You guys are serving organizations that serve the people who are struggling or have some type of food insecurity. I said, you know, Amazon has figured this out. If I buy a phone, they'll say, might you need a case? So what would happen then if we got so smart and said, we notice you're struggling to pay for food. Might you be struggling to pay for technology as well? And how do we empower people to take advantage of the offerings that we can provide? I think that's the way that I would love to see that happen.
Joshua Edmonds is Detroit's new Director of Digital Inclusion. And please come back and keep us posted on the work you're doing. It would be great to talk with you again and follow the progress.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Before we go, I want to remind you, Stateside will have a brand new host beginning Monday, January 6th. Veteran public radio journalist April Baer joins us from Oregon Public Radio as her family returns to their Midwest stomping grounds. And I know that she would like to hear from you. Let her know what stories you're focused on, what issues that you want to hear more about. You can find her on Twitter at April Baer, that's B-A-E-R, or email your ideas to stateside@michiganradio.org. And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.